Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From hanselminutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 539. In this episode, Scott talks with André Goulet from CorgiBytes about working with legacy code.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. I'm here at .NET Fringe in Portland, Oregon, and we're at the Crystal Ballroom. So if you hear the background noise, it's because there's a conference happening around us. And I'm now here with André Goulet from CorgiBytes Software, who just got off stage doing her fantastic opening keynote. And you specialize, if I understand correctly, in legacy code. That's part of your consultancy.
Yes. So CorgiBytes, Corgi like the dog, and our tagline is old code, new tricks.
Nice. So legacy code, old code, what is the definition of legacy code? Like how old is it and when does it become legacy?
Yeah. So the way that we kind of think about it is that legacy code is code that's difficult to work with. And Michael Feathers has a really kind of accepted definition of legacy code in that it is code without tests. And the way that we've been kind of exploring this over the past several years, because whenever I've talked to people about that definition, it tends to be kind of divisive because some people are saying, well, how much test coverage do you need? Should you get 100%? And the way that I started thinking about it was, a test is really just an artifact of your intention or your idea. And so there are other artifacts. There are commit messages. There are the way you name your variables. There are error messages. There are so many different types of things that are in the code that are English and are not the programming language that you're working in. And so legacy code is code that doesn't have communication artifacts so that you can go back and either revisit what your rationale was, or if you're picking up a new project that was inherited, that you can learn what the intention was. It's almost like archaeology in a way.
That's funny. I love that you said that because I was literally going to say, isn't this a kind of archaeology? You're describing the picking up after this civilization.
Yes.
That is trying to express its intent.
Yes.
But, you know, all of the stone tablets cracked and now we just have the pieces.
Yes. And the reason that legacy code is relevant is because there are so many business applications that are generating revenue and the monetary, let's just scrap it all. Let's just bulldoze this app and start from scratch doesn't make monetary sense. And so similar to how the human body reinvents itself every 7 years, just through continuous improvement, like the cells that are in your body today are not the same that were 7 years ago. You can use continuous improvement, continuous delivery, continuous integration. We use continuous estimating even.
Right.
Where it's just regular ongoing conversations, regular ongoing improvement, and you can transform an application that way.
But you're describing things, concepts that at least in my world of software didn't exist 20 years ago. Like we were just thinking about unit testing at that time.
Right.
And you're describing continuous this and continuous that. We didn't have a lot of continuous stuff.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the idea with pretty much all of that is to shorten the feedback loops.
Mm.
And so that's why communication becomes so important when you're talking about legacy code. Because part of the reason why legacy code is notoriously difficult to work with is because the feedback loops are really, really long. So if you have to go hunt down some documentation from a developer who doesn't work there anymore, right? That's a lot of kind of steps that you have to go through, or if you have to reverse engineer something. Traditionally, it's not quick and easy. The documentation isn't readily available. But I found the reason that we got started in this was because my business partner happened to really like these types of projects.
Is he the only person that thinks that's a good idea?
You know, when we first started, because we had been in business for about 6 years, and we were a general all-purpose software development shop.
Mm-hmm.
And one day we were watching This Old House.
Oh, the remodeling show.
The remodeling show. And we both kind of had this epiphany, like, that's what we do with software. We take applications that need to still, that have a good integration, good bones, you know.
Yeah.
And you can still work with them. But, you know, maybe they need an updated kitchen, you know. So we started looking at, you know, things like, you know, you can look at the way that things are structured, you know, and kind of peeking behind walls. So we did things like, with one of our clients, they were doing, they were looking for some performance issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so we deleted a bunch of features.
Refactoring via subtraction.
Absolutely. I think we won't talk about delete. I sometimes call it KonMari, which is the art of tidying up. And it's this idea of, you know, software has entropy, right? So it's naturally moving to a chaotic state. So you have to actively clean up like you would in your house, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, if you don't take the trash out of your house, you're going to have a big mess. And if you don't delete code every once in a while, you're going to have a big mess as well. But it's being able to know how to do that safely, that's really important.
Yeah.
So, so that's where tests and automated testing and all the continuous integration comes in handy.
So are you saying that you believe that one should add tests after the fact and wrap tests around old code?
Yeah. So that's kind of what we do, is that every time we touch something. So it's kind of Bob Martin talks about how it's the Boy Scout rule.
Where
every time you touch something, make it better. So that's typically how we do it. Sometimes, and it depends on the client context, right? Mm-hmm. So some clients really want to get a massive productivity boost from their team.
Okay.
And they're not doing any automated testing. So we'll take a sprint or two and we'll build them an automated testing framework. And then they'll go in and populate the tests. And we've seen clients who they've doubled their team's productivity just by doing that. But other clients where it's like, you know, it's not so much the team productivity, I've got developers, then it's like more of a, you know, kind of slow and steady kind
right.
of process.
Well, you're setting them up for success. You're building the framework for them to be successful. I think that the remodeling analogy works, because as soon as you're saying this, that you build out a framework, it reminds me of when you're doing like a barn raising. I don't know anything about a barn raising, but if somebody can help me with the framework part,
yes,
I can do the push really hard on the wall part,
yes,
you know, and get the thing to turn into an actual wall.
Yeah. And we also find that when you're trying to adhere to some of these principles, there's a lot of inertia
mm-hmm.
in trying to kind of change your behavior. And so sometimes it does help. Like, I think sometimes about the organization shows where they have the, you know, organizer who comes in and just kind of like cleans your house and gets
right.
everything set up. It's much easier to maintain something if you have professional help to kind of come in and do that. So in some ways we're helping and we're working right alongside. Other times we get, you know, we're going to build up tech debt and we know it, and that's the way our developers are.
Right.
Would you come kind of clean up behind us? And we're happy to do that too. We've noticed that there's two different personality types of software developers. So as we started going through this, we started figuring out, like, who are the people who like working on this? And so Scott did a tour where he was giving a talk on this, and he would always ask, you know, who in here really likes working on legacy code? And in a room of 200 people, he'd get maybe two hands. So not a whole lot of people, but the people who do like this type of work really like it, because you are working on some of the most interesting engineering problems that you can. Like, we've done projects where there is a homegrown database. Like, it was built completely from scratch, a modern application that just for some reason decided to build their own database, no documentation. And so we went in and extracted everything from the binary files. And I, looking at your face right now, you're like, no. That sounds like horrible.
It really sounds very painful. It sounds like the opposite of fun to me.
The people on my team and people who identify as menders, I mean, it was like Christmas.
So what are the two types?
So there's makers, right? So makers like doing, I mean, there's a whole culture around makers, right? Make magazine, Maker Faire. But there's not really a culture around people who like to fix things. And so we identified Scott as the type of person who's like, I really like taking a project that has kind of been abandoned and making it better. So I find that there are a lot of people in the open source world who fall into menders because they really like contributing to something that maybe somebody else built. So we decided, well, we'll go out this. We thought that the hang up for us was going to be talent.
Because we're like
finding people who are menders. And we found that it's actually been the opposite. Because menders, there is very little community around these people. And so we have a whole slew of people who have emailed us and said, yes, I want to come work for you, which I did not think was going to happen. I thought we were going to have a slew of clients because there's so many legacy projects out there. But I actually have a backlog of developers who I would love to hire. And so now I'm out there looking for the projects that are the right fit. And I think one of the reasons that our developers really like us too is that to make a mender happy, and in engineers in general, you know, I'm solving interesting problems.
Right.
Which that in and of itself, recognizing that if you build your entire business model around, I'm going to find interesting problems for my engineers to work on, like that will attract people. But when people ask me, they're like, how do you get so many lead developers who are good at this work? I'm like, well, I built my entire culture around making our developers happy. You know, we give them really good resources, fast computers, and then we get out of their way. I give them a lot of autonomy.
But working on interesting problems is one thing, and I think it's easy to say that, but there's also the idea of moving forward. I feel like, am I moving forward on the project? Am I making forward technical progress? Am I improving myself as a developer?
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things we do there is we have 10% time. So we have 4 hours a week of dedicated professional development every week where, you know, it's go research a new language. It's go learn something. The other thing that we do is when you're working in legacy code, you know, it's usually several different languages that are all cobbled together in different ways. So we say any language, any platform, any framework. So it's the opportunity to continue to learn in there.
Are there projects that can't be saved? Do you go and you say, oh, this is VB3. We can't do that.
We have. Yeah. And typically, yeah, I mean, we had a client who, didn't have a lot of users. They were still pre-revenue. They were very much a startup and their CTO was using .NET web forms. And we're like,
hang on now. Yeah. Web forms. I work on that team.
Yeah.
how old, right? Like, it's funny.
Brand new.
That's very interesting that this is where the conversation will get controversial. Yeah. Because web forms is actively developed, and I'm not saying this in defense, but was it about the tech or was it about the way it was written? Funny story about legacy code that I haven't talked to you about yet, but my blog runs on web forms from 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And people often ask, well, why do you keep it like that? Why don't you upgrade it? And I said, well, it works great. It works really fine. So what we did is we put tests around it.
Yeah.
And I work with a gentleman on Twitter named Papa String, Mark Downey, who helps me with DOS Blog, because we both love the code base and we don't see any reason to work for a year to rewrite it and then just be exactly where we already are now.
And that's a great point because it all comes down to the business driver, right? So for this particular client, they wanted to scale very, very rapidly.
I see.
They were having a difficult time attracting developers who could work in that. They wanted to build the API in a particular way. The front end developers who were coming in were wanting to build more RESTful things, and the CTO was just almost dogmatic in this. Really? I'm not going to let go of this technology. This is the way I know how to build things, and therefore everybody else must conform to me.
Yep.
And the CEO was getting frustrated because she just saw her team wasn't working. And she couldn't quite understand the technology behind it. So we came in and you know, just we do what we call a software inspection, a code inspection. And so we just listed out and said, you know, here are the different things based on your business goals. You know, here are some frameworks that may be, you know, more attuned to your particular needs. Not saying that, you know.
No, but you're describing exactly the right scenario where this was someone with a, and some people don't like this term, but a religious bent. They were, they were not just excited about a religion, but they were like a zealot for this thing. And like this round peg is going to fit in this square hole no matter what.
Yes.
And I can agree with you that while Webforms runs my blog, it runs a lot of great websites. If you're going to build a giant RESTful application with AngularJS, it's, you know, you're going to bump into some real problems.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point you got to let go.
Yeah. So for that particular client, we ended up letting go of all of the web forms because we said, you know, you don't have any users. There's not a lot of value. There's not a lot of business value in keeping the code base the way it is. So we got in and they were able to replace a lot of the infrastructure with what they needed, you know, in a matter of a couple of months.
This episode of Hansel Minutes is brought to you by Braintree Payments. Why make payment integration more difficult than it has to be? Braintree's powerful full-stack payment platform allows you to accept nearly any type of payment from any device with one integration. It's flexible to your system's needs, supports most programming languages. So whether you're using Java, Ruby, or Python, you'll always have a range of server-side and client-side SDKs available. Braintree makes payments and your job a whole lot easier. You can learn more at braintreepayments.com/Hanselman. So they keep the brain, they keep the data access, they keep the parts that were not holding them back.
Yeah. And now they're achieving their business goals. Now, other clients is going to be completely different, right? If you have a million users, right? And we have clients like this too, where it's like, it is not an option, right? This is a black box and you cannot change this. You know, then it's working within it. So one of the core values that we have at CorgiBytes is what we say craftsmanship in context. And so it's the idea of when you're thinking about the technology choices that you're making, you have to remember the business context in which you are using them. So for you and your blog, right, there's not a lot of business value for you upgrading, right? You've put in, you know, things in place. And that's the same way with a house, right? Like if you're going to go and sell your house, then there's going to be a lot of kind of return on your investment. You know, maybe you'll update the kitchen or paint the walls. But if you're just like, you know what, I don't really mind the walls and, you know, yeah, it'd be nice.
You know, that is a really great way to look at it because I know exactly what's wrong. The two things wrong with my blog are it can only scale to a point. It just happens to be a point I haven't reached yet.
Yeah.
And I don't like the URLs.
Yeah. And you're willing to live with it,
but
right?
But do I have the 9 months or whatever to go and rewrite the thing from scratch? There's all sorts of great things I like about it. You know, it's got a creaky floor and I like the kitchen, you know.
It's got character.
It is a fixer-upper. It's got character, but I enjoy it very much and I'm not willing to throw it out quite yet. So yeah. I like that. But I think that your point is that having my eyes wide open about the business requirements, the ones that I'm willing to feel that are not being met well, the aspects that are subpar, all of that is being conscious about my legacy code base.
Yeah.
As opposed to being delusional about it.
Yes. And so, you know, I think of legacy code almost this way, right? So, you know, 10, 15 years ago, we had the agile movement where we said, you know what, change is inevitable. Let's just learn how to embrace it and work with it rather than like ignoring it and just pretending that it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we can go through a similar shift with legacy code. So let's just acknowledge that code bases are going to stick around and that the majority of us work on applications that are not brand new. And once we just kind of mentally acknowledge that and start looking at legacy code as something that can be interesting, something that you can learn from, something that you can grow from. The other thing that's interesting too is that you don't have to use antiquated tools to, you can use very modern tooling to work on an older code base. So the analogy that I use sometimes is if you bought a house that was 100 years old, you wanted to remodel it and you wanted to update it, you wouldn't just use hand drills. You would go out to the hardware store and you would buy power drills. So
that is very,
you can think about getting your new shiny more in the tooling rather than in the, you know, kind of core pieces of the application.
Right. You could have a 15-year-old web application and they use, you know, the most modern Selenium web driver.
Absolutely.
And Node to drive the whole thing.
Absolutely.
Or use the latest .NET testing techniques on a 10-year-old .NET application.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. So when we've been exploring this metaphor for a couple of years and we've been waiting for it to break down and it kind of hasn't yet. It's one of these things that I think once you just start realizing that, you know, there are people who like doing the new construction, they like kind of just getting something up to speed and then handing it off and recognizing that, yeah, there are many of us who like inheriting a project, and it is all about putting the right people in the right places.
Right.
Right. Don't have the people who enjoy doing the making and the, you know, don't have them writing, fixing bugs. Have them on new features and exploratory things, and then have the people who are menders, like those are the people that you want doing bug fixes because they love it.
Right. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you about is that, you know, 15, 20 years ago, even 20 plus years ago, I was doing, you know, VB3 and VB5. Things moved in a slower pace. You would write code in VB for a year or 18 months, and then maybe a minor version would come out, but you didn't have a sense that the world was shifting underneath you. But I literally, for example, yesterday updated a Node application to the latest something, and one of the libraries, which I think was made like Tuesday, told me it was deprecated. And then you go and look at another library's documentation that depends on that deprecated one, and it says, yeah, don't worry about that. We know about that message. You can ignore that. Things are getting deprecated like hourly.
Yeah.
Legacy code literally could be what I wrote last week.
Absolutely. I love that you say that. Yeah. And it, again, it comes down to communication, right? So are you monitoring that? Are you thinking about that? Are you documenting your ideas and your rationale? And so that when things happen and when things break, you remember that and you can keep that mental model in your head.
People don't. And I think I'll use Node as an example, and we'll say .NET Core, because like .NET Core is brand new. Like it's a month old. People are writing tomorrow's legacy code today. And I don't think that they're thinking about things like versions, right? Like I had a Node application, like I was saying, I upgraded it. I'm a bad person, but I upgraded it yesterday to the latest version of Node because it was the latest version of Node. You know what I mean? And it worked. But I honestly feel like that was quite a roll of a dice right there. But I didn't write it down that I upgraded from 3.whatever to 4.whatever. I don't really know what the library tree or the dependency tree looks like. So that if you said 10 years from now, get back here, who knows if NPM repository is going to be around, that those libraries will exist anymore. I need to freeze dry that into Amber. Or a VM or something so that I can rebuild this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so this is where it gets into empathy, which when I was doing my strategic plan around we're going to work on legacy code, we worked with a strategic consultant and she told me, you can't use the word empathy in tech. You'll never be taken seriously.
I am wondering where you're going with this.
Well, the idea of you have to take a perspective. You have to first learn and understand what the needs are of the people that you're working with. And that person could be your future self. It could be yourself 3 months from now. And you have to be able to step into that person's shoes and say, okay, what is their need? So it could be your client. It could be your users, you know, and
no, that makes sense to me because you're not.
Empathy is so critical.
Yeah. Yeah.
To building software these days.
because you can use that word and say, oh, this is touchy-feely and hard. This hardware, you know, hardware and software, that's not touchy-feely. Just give me the version numbers I need to use. But what you're saying is that I need to transfer momentarily and imagine myself 6 months down the road when I dig that code back up and I think to myself, future self, how do I build this?
Yeah. What am I going to need in 6 months to make it easier for me to context switch and easier for me to remember where I am? My favorite story is, you know, almost all of us have run Git blame, like in a heat of fury, being really angry, like who would have done it this way? And it ends up being yourself,
SVN,
right?
Yeah. SVN blame before that. And It's like when you go and you Google for a problem and you find the one post where you're asking for the problem and no one has ever answered. You're all alone in the world.
Yeah.
It was you.
Yeah. And to get back to your point about dependencies, I think one of the things that is particularly challenging with legacy code is that you cannot create a repeatable process around it. Because if we look at dependencies and if we look at mathematically chaos theory, the more dependencies and the more interdependencies that you have in a system, the less likely you are to be able to accurately estimate. So this is part of where there's a lot of controversy and like there's a no estimates hashtag on Twitter. And so the idea is if you're working on a greenfield application, you can do a project. If you're doing UI, if you're doing a lot of front end stuff, you know, that's more of a complicated system where it's just a series of steps and you can have a lot of confidence in its estimating. We don't estimate, I call it continuous estimation. So I work completely on retainer. We do short retainers and we say, you stop paying us when you stop getting value.
Right.
And that forces a budget discussion regularly. And if people ask me about estimates, the way that I go about that is we give a confidence value. So we say, you know, I'm 30% confident I'll be able to get this done in a week.
Right. Well, this is the progress, the universal progress bar problem.
Yes.
What we really need is a progress bar with a number over the top of it that tells us the confidence level that the progress bar has.
Yeah.
In, you know, because we always joke about the progress bar getting to 99% and then just sitting there for a day or two because, you know, you don't know. But
yeah.
You're supposed to know the estimate the closer you get to it.
Right.
You asymptotically approach the ending of the estimate.
And so that's one of the things I tell new clients because they're like, well, what would it take for you to get an accurate estimate? I was like, I need to be able to get to the point where I've solved your problem.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point,
when I'm done, I'll give you an accurate.
So we do everything time and materials. And I mean, so it's been a really interesting way to kind of look at this system, which has been, I think, overlooked, but there's a lot of business value. There's a lot of people who are trying to look at this problem. And I look at it in a way almost like, you know, we know that our workforce is aging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our software applications are aging as well. And there are people who, you know, are going to have to maintain them. We get called in regularly because this one person has known this system for 20 years and now they're ready to retire. And if that one person leaves, we're going to be sunk because this is the main driver of our revenue.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, I think, business opportunity in legacy code as well, but it does create kind of a little bit of a mind shift.
Well, and getting it down to a repeatable build and also formalizing the hosting of the thing. Like this is an opportunity for a lot of what they call lift and shift into the cloud, where it's like, you know, that expense reporting system that, you know, Anna wrote 20 years ago. Well, it's been running under her desk.
Yes.
You know, the whole time. And she's retiring. Now what?
Yeah. We call, the people who work on our team code whisperers because we don't use the term developer because in order to do this, you have to have software development skills. You have to have some business analysis skills
right.
to understand the business context, testing, You know, you have to be part tester. You have to be project manager. So we have a very, very flat organization where we hire people who have all of these skills. And again, people were like, you're going to be crazy. No one is ever going to be able to work for you. But surprisingly, there are a lot of people out there who have all of these skills and have been looking to do this type of work.
This is pretty senior work. I mean, it's you wouldn't come out of high school or coming out of college rather. And no. This would be your first job.
We have no, I would.
Not to be ageist. I'm just saying that, like, this would be, when I retire, this would be a good job for me to do.
Yeah, we have, I would say I am the least seasoned person on our team, and I've been coding for 8 years. You know, several people have 30 plus years of experience for sure. But I mean, yeah, it's just that building up of context and being able to just dive in, and it's like, oh, I've seen this problem before, but right. You know, we have someone on our team who's taken an IBMI mainframe and upgraded it to Ruby on Rails, right? So it's knowing how to integrate all of the different pieces together.
Yeah.
So that it's functioning, it's working well, it's going to, you know, serve the needs of whatever the business is, you know, for years to come.
Two fun things that I wanted to share with you to see if you saw. The first one was that there was a 17-year-old who bought a mainframe on eBay.
Seriously? That's awesome.
He, like, this is your legacy code. You need to have this person on your team. He bought a mainframe. It was a $200,000 mainframe that he bought for like $300. And he had to like go to Rutgers and like rent a truck and have it like get out. And he put it back together and he put it on the internet. Like he got it running again.
Yes.
It took him months.
And see, that's the thing is the, like, this is the most interesting challenge and mm-hmm. I am going to stick with it until I freaking solve it.
I mean, he had to buy certain kind of cables. He had to talk, and he was talking to people in their 60s about, like, you know, how did this used to work and getting that thing booted up and then getting modern Ethernet to plug into this thing. That's the first thing I wanted to share with you. And then the second thing, did you see that the Apollo landing code?
Yes. So we have, we opened an open.
Tell people what happened.
Oh, okay. So the Apollo 11 landing, moon lander. So there have been several projects lately that have been open sourced. So they open sourced DOS a few years ago, mm-hmm. which was awesome. So we've went in and looked at that. They also looked at open source Prince of Persia, which I played.
Yes, Apple Jordan too. Mechner put all that code online.
Yeah. So there have been some wonderful, kind of standards. So if you look at jazz or if you look at literature, you know, there are standards that you go to look for and say, how is this structured? What can I learn? How can I learn how to code? So one of the things that we're doing is there's a project that I'm doing as a side gig called Legacy Code Rocks. And there's a GitHub repo. And one of the things on there is, awesome legacy code. So we're starting to compile and curate a list of all of the different open source, you know, things that are out there. Yeah. I hope so. I really have just thoroughly enjoyed learning about this. There's so much interesting work here and it's such a good way to bridge people and talk to people. So like yourself. So,
well, thanks so much for chatting today.
Absolutely. This has been a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Andrea Goulet from Corgi Bytes. We'll put her website and Twitter and the link to her GitHub repo in the show notes. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.